everybody, and thanks for listening to the Miles Podcast. This is your host, Stephen Miller. Today, I have Ryan Ferrante from the Chicagoland area, and he is a reproductive lawyer. So today, we'll be talking about like what that is, what the day in the life of Ryan, what that looks like, but also talking about advocacy for Resolves, like Federal Advocacy Day, as well as Building Families Wisconsin, and why that's important and what that experience is like. So
thanks for having me, Stephen. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I'm always interested when I have guests on is, how did you learn about infertility?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of people discover or become aware of infertility in a number of different ways. But my wife, Lindsay, and I did not become aware of infertility by accident. We were married in 2013, and we immediately tried to start having a family. We tried naturally, and then we listened to reproductive endocrinologists about when we should be trying naturally. It's really romantic, that timed intercourse whenever you're trying to have a family, other than the old-fashioned way. But after years of trying to have our own family, we knew we were going to need some additional support, and so medical intervention was necessary for us. We went through three cycles of IVF at a clinic here in Chicago. We did not have any success there creating embryos, and so we ended up at a clinic in Colorado where we were able to create some embryos, but we also always knew that my wife was not going to be able to carry. And so we, sort of threw ourselves into the surrogacy process as well, worked with an agency, identified a surrogate. Fast forward, long story short, we did work with an incredible surrogate in the state of Florida who carried both of our children. And we now have two children, both products of IVF and gestational surrogacy. And so in the midst of all of that, which is, a much lengthier conversation about all the details and all of the efforts that we put into having a family, we relied on Resolve, the National Infertility Association, throughout much of that process because we were new to it then. I say that I was a boring old corporate tax attorney at the time. I didn't know much about coverage for fertility, infertility, and surrogacy, and who do we ask, what and when, and how do we figure out how we're going to pay for this? And so the resources that were available to us on Resolve were really valuable to us. And so that's when we started thinking about how do we give back to them. And so we donated where we could, and we participated in Walks of Hope. And that's just scratching the surface of some of the efforts that we've had as far as helping the National Infertility Association.
Yeah, and that surrogacy journey, like, it's a lengthy one, and there's a lot of dynamics that go into that. And you think about contracts and personality. I mean, like, there's just so many factors that really go into a successful experience.
Yeah, and there's no real place other than the agencies or people who have been through it before, or the attorneys for that matter, that people can really use as a resource to sort of determine what is the playbook here. How do we go about this? Who do we talk to first? Do we talk to the clinic? Do we talk to the lawyer? Do we talk to the agency? Mm. So, it obviously all starts with the clinic. So clinic resources should be able to point people in the right direction, but that's unfortunately not always the case.
Okay. So you were a corporate tax lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did your switch to like doing more of like the reproductive side, was it because of that experience then?
Oh yeah, 100%. That was 100% the reason for pursuing that pivot in my career, which was to leave the big corporate experience and start my own practice in an area of the law that I was not practicing previously. And so I sort of just opened my own office. I did what most people don't do anymore, which is I wrote letters to every agency and lawyer who practices in the area about my desire to help people have a family. And so My pivot was unique in that it was completely unrelated to the work that I had done. But as we were engaging in gestational surrogacy through an agency and needing our own lawyer in Florida, that's when all of this started to develop, because I did what I would have done in my old practice, which is I sort of threw myself into the law and tried to understand mm-hmm. everything I possibly could. I read everything I could get my hands on so that I can understand what the legal landscape looked like for us, you know, a couple yeah. in Illinois who's working with a gestational surrogate in Florida. How do we establish our legal parentage? Because it's not going to be, you know, my wife that delivers the child. And so there were a number of things that I was really, it was very, very new to me. And so,
yeah.
The landscape of gestational surrogacy has evolved since, you know, I started practicing in this area, but because some states have, you know, passed statutes that sort of lay out the requirements for gestational surrogacy. On the other end of that, unfortunately, there are still criminal penalties for compensating someone to carry a child in one state, but you know, in other states, it's not as easy as it is in a place like Illinois, where yeah. I live. So
yeah, I was going to mention that too, because I think it's like Michigan that had like that is right. illegal. Because right. I remember that it was my sister-in-law. It's like one of her best friends was a surrogate, and her family was from Michigan, from the UP, like the Upper Peninsula and stuff. And especially towards the end there, like she was not going into Michigan at all, you know, just because of something happened. And then things were to find out and stuff, because it was like a felony charge, I think, from what I remember. But yeah, it plays a factor, especially in the Midwest. You know, like I know Nebraska and was it Louisiana that has some more difficulties, but
that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
There's some pretty murky laws there in Nebraska and Louisiana, and Michigan has that criminal exposure for being compensated as a surrogate. And so it's not something that we can do in any state without complications, or with, you know, you need legal advice yeah. in all situations, regardless of state, to make sure
that
you're pursuing an arrangement that is compliant with local law.
Yeah. Well, even in, I think some countries are, and especially in Europe, don't allow it. I think it's in like Italy, I thought was one of them. Maybe I'm trying to think of
it. We probably have part two.
Yeah.
Global surrogacy and part three, yeah. quite frankly.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, because here in the United States, it's it has become attractive to pursue gestational surrogacy for couples outside the United States, because it may be banned in their own country.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like the avenue of reproductive tourism. So what's a typical day then for you? You know, like what does that look like?
When I started my own practice, and I suppose you could say that I am, you know, a collaborative reproduction attorney or an assisted reproduction attorney or any of the other number of names that somebody might use to describe the type of work that I do. I'm a solo practitioner in Chicago. I'm licensed to practice in Illinois and Missouri.
Okay.
But I suppose you can say that my day is back to back to back providing counsel or having these types of conversations to anyone who wants to be a parent. But the process to becoming a parent requires some sort of medical intervention, and specifically the cases that involve a third party. So assisted reproduction would be, you know, couples pursuing family building through IVF or IUI. But once you bring in the third party, like a surrogate or a donor, egg donor, sperm donor, embryo donor, and intended parents in the same arrangement, those are the cases that I'm involved in. So to sort of summarize that, the term collaborative reproduction, which is what I'm focused on, does not include the birth of a child conceived by means of sexual intercourse or the birth mm-hmm. of a child conceived through assisted reproduction, even though I'm still having a lot of those conversations about, you know, recommendations for people about clinics that they might want to look into becoming a patient at. And so any really third party reproduction arrangement should always involve legal counsel, just because there's got to be a relinquishment of rights and an acceptance of rights when it comes to any child born as a result of those arrangements. So I would say that, you know, it's really sort of 50-50, a lot of donation arrangements and a lot of surrogacy arrangements that have some connection or sufficient nexus to the state of Illinois. And those are the two states where I'm licensed.
Okay. So I would imagine like doing contracts, right? Because having those legal contracts, there's a lot that goes into those. Right. And a lot of the hypotheticals and stuff that, because usually they will have some sort of, I wouldn't say evaluation, but like some sort of psycho ad about like what it's going to be like for an intended parent, you know, like what are some of the worst case scenarios that we hope that doesn't happen. But when in the event that it does, like it's spelling out, you know, like in the contract. And so like, what are some of those like details and stuff that are like commonly discussed?
Excellent, excellent question, because this is sort of the great unknown for a lot of parties when they are pursuing these types of arrangements. They're thinking to themselves, what's going to be in my contract, right? It obviously depends on the type of arrangement we're talking about. In a surrogacy arrangement, again, very important to have independent legal representation for both parties, right? Both parties should be receiving legal advice independent of the advice that the other party is receiving. Mm-hmm. And so I always think about surrogacy really in two buckets, at least the legal processes that need to be accomplished. And so that first bucket is the contract, the direct agreement between the intended parents and their surrogate and her spouse, if she has one.
Yeah.
And so the attorney who represents the intended parents 99 times out of 100 is going to be the drafting attorney who puts together the first draft of the agreement. And so intended parents really have sort of the first crack at the draft. So their hopes and their desires and intentions for the arrangement are sort of documented first. Now, the financial terms may already be set, because if they're working with an agency, the parties have already agreed to what any sort of compensation or fees may look like. But in the contract itself, other than the financial terms, we're thinking about, first of all, in Illinois, we have those requirements that I said are laid out in the statute. Both parties have to have a mental health assessment by a licensed mental health professional to determine their qualifications to participate in an arrangement like this. They have to have a medical assessment by the treating reproductive endocrinologist saying that the surrogate is qualified based on a review of her medical records and a physical to determine whether or not she's an appropriate candidate for surrogacy. So we discuss all of the requirements and how the parties have met the threshold of those requirements. Then we start to talk, if you're getting into a sort of a chronological assessment of the contract, the requirements first, and then we start to talk about the surrogate's conduct, her lifestyle, the things that she needs to be thinking about as she prepares for an embryo transfer. Basic rule, listen to the physician, right?
Yeah.
Then we shift into a conversation about her conduct during the pregnancy, her lifestyle, the things that she needs to be focused on in order to participate in a way that is most likely to lead to a successful outcome. There's also conversations about travel restrictions. And so I'm going to pause on that first bucket for a second, that contract, to talk about the second bucket, because it relates to the travel restriction.
Okay.
The second bucket that I'm focused on often, most often in surrogacy arrangements, is the establishment of legal parentage, right? Because there's a presumption that when a pregnant woman walks into a delivery hospital, that she's delivering her legal, natural, and biological child. And so depending on state law, which will determine how we rebut that presumption, state law will tell us this is what you need to do to make sure that the intended parents become the legal parents. Okay.
Yeah.
And so we have every hope that she is going to deliver at that hospital where she intended to deliver. Because if she doesn't, that hospital and maybe even that state where she does deliver, if she crosses state lines, does not know that she is not carrying her own legal, natural, and biological child, right?
Right.
So we've done a lot of work in this second bucket prior to the birth to make sure that everyone involved knows that she's not carrying her own child, okay? And so that's what we're trying to accomplish in the second bucket. But back to the contract, if we talk about the travel restriction, what I am doing for intended parents is making sure that we're doing everything we can to limit travel once she reaches a certain stage in the pregnancy. So for example, once she reaches the third trimester, generally, she's not permitted to leave the state where she intends to deliver, because we're going to have done work to establish the intended parents in that state.
Yeah. Okay?
So there's a travel restriction, and then there's a conversation about a potential termination of pregnancy, right? Obviously a very, very hot topic. Now, by the time the parties have retained counsel, the hope is that they've had a conversation about what a potential termination of pregnancy would look like, meaning what are the circumstances in which the intended parents may request that a pregnancy is terminated. Obviously, where every surrogacy arrangement and every surrogacy contract is written through the lens of protecting the surrogate's health under all circumstances. Okay. Right. So, you know, if there's ever a balance that needs to be done about, you know, regarding decisions, the child's health or the surrogate's health, we're always contemplating the surrogate's health first. And so there is a very lengthy discussion about the intentions of the parties when it comes to a potential termination or reduction of pregnancy if there's an imminent threat to the health or life of the surrogate.
Yeah.
And so then when we talk about what does the delivery look like? You know, she's got to notify the intended parents immediately upon the onset of labor, obviously, when practicable. She needs to, we lay out as much as we can what the delivery room looks like, who's going to be present. And I say as much as we can because it's always going to be subject to the policies of the facility and the delivery hospital.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sometimes we get into some harsh language like gestational surrogates shall surrender physical custody of the child immediately upon birth. That's language directly from the Illinois statute. So it just depends on the jurisdiction in which the contract is written. And then we talk about health insurance. How is this going to be paid for? Whose health insurance is going to be used? What happens if that health insurance goes away? What are the obligations of the parties when it comes to preserving that insurance? And then there's just a number of other factors that intended parents and surrogates need to come to terms on prior to an embryo transfer. But that gives you an indication of some of the things that we're thinking about at the outset and have to be included in every single agreement.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there's been situations where you get thrown a curveball of like, this was not, you know, like, and we didn't think about that, you know.
Yeah.
And then being able to like circle back and say like, how do we address this? And
I'll give you an example. It's a really great question. This is obviously a worst case scenario, but I do have a case right now where there is one thing I didn't mention about a requirement in the contract is that the intended parents are not just naming emergency contacts to make medical decisions in case they cannot be reached, in case there's a question regarding the child's health, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the intended parents get to weigh in. But if they're not available, who's their emergency contact? Who do they trust to make medical decisions on their behalf? Also, temporary custodians. If the intended parents, for some weather event or some other reason, can't make it to the hospital, whose custody will the child be discharged to when the discharge occurs? And then the point I was going to make is that we also have to think about guardians, right? And so in case something happens to the intended parents during pregnancy, who are they hereby naming as guardians for the child until, you know, legal guardianship can be established in court? Now, the case that I'm working on right now, I represent a surrogate who was working with a single intended parent, and obviously not going to share any names, but
yeah,
the intended mother got very ill right after the embryo transfer and passed right on as the surrogate learned that there was a confirmation of heartbeat. And so we had established that the intended parent wanted A and B to be the legal guardians in that case. But it is complicated. It's not, there are certain measures and steps that need to be taken in order to establish the guardians as the legal parents. So those are the types of things. If they have a greater than zero chance of occurring, lawyers should be thinking about them. And so those are the things that we're documenting in the contract.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really unfortunate and probably a lot of emotion behind those conversations as well.
Yeah.
And managing all that. So I remember when I had did a presentation up at Northern Michigan University, and one of our professors, we were having a drink afterwards, and he asked me the question, because we were talking about surrogacy and contracts. And so he asked the question of, it's like, if you have a contract regarding like lifestyle, right? and the gestational surrogate all of a sudden is like using alcohol or smoke, you know, like, is that grounds for an intended parent to like sue the basically the surrogate? You know, I said, like, it's like, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have an answer to that. But
yeah. So it's a really great question. Now, one thing that is always addressed in the contract is that the surrogate agrees to take tests if requested by the intended parents or the physician. Obviously, alcohol and drug testing would be available. Now, she also has agreed not to, or I should say she's agreed to follow all doctor's instructions, which would include no alcohol or drugs during pregnancy.
Right.
And so if that were to happen, obviously we would want to get some testing done to make sure. And then if there was a breach of agreement, all legal remedies would be available to the intended parents. Now, the approach to that would be something that would have to be handled very delicately because she is carrying her child still, right? And so,
sure.
And so what legal remedies are available to them depends on the contract. But in general, there needs to be something in the agreement that states that she, you know, will or may be forfeiting any potential compensation. She may have to reimburse the intended parents for any compensation paid to that point. It really just depends on the contract, but those are some of the remedies that I've seen.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to switch gears.
I do want to make one other comment, though, about under all circumstances, the intended parents will still be the legal parents of the child. There's no relinquishment in the contract if there's a breach. Meaning if, you know, the intended parents can't say that they don't want to be the legal parents to the child anymore. They've already agreed to that in the contract. The establishment hasn't necessarily occurred yet, but they will always be the legal parents.
Oh, that's good to know for sure.
Yeah.
So you and I had met last year, probably around this time or maybe a little bit later. Yeah. I think it was May with Resolve, like a federal advocacy day. And I just am curious about, like, I know through that experience, you got involved with Resolve. And I wanted to talk about like federal advocacy day as well, because that is right around the corner. Mm-hmm. That's literally probably a month away, you know, a little bit less than a month. And what does that look like from your end? Because I know you do a lot of work ahead of time, and then as a volunteer last year and advocating, like, I showed up, I did a little training and then shared my experience. But I know there's so much work that goes into that. Yeah. So I'm curious about like what goes into that. And then two, if somebody is to volunteer to be like to do that, like, what does that look like?
For sure. So I'm happy to talk as much about this as you want. I mentioned earlier, Lindsay and I were looking for ways to sort of, you know, help anyone who's gone through the experience that we have, or help any of the organizations that were so meaningful to us during our infertility experience. And so, you know, I mentioned we did the Walks of Hope and we raised money where we could and made donations. But for me personally, I wanted to do a little bit more. And so, you know, this is what I do for a living, is I advocate for my clients. And so I thought that the advocacy piece that Resolve really relies on was something that was an area that I think I thought I could make a significant impact. And so, I went to my first advocacy day, which I'll explain in a second. My first advocacy day was the last advocacy day where it was done in person, where advocates from all over the country went to Washington. And the idea behind Advocacy Day is that Resolve, this National Infertility Association — I don't know how much your audience knows about Resolve. I think it's probably helpful to explain that Resolve is a nonprofit organization, and their focus is promoting reproductive health. And they have a staff that really works pretty tirelessly to ensure equal access to all family building options for men and women who are experiencing infertility or some other reproductive barrier.
Yeah.
They're very, very good, Resolve, at reminding anyone who listens to their message that infertility is a disease, that people need to be constantly reminded that it is a disease. and it affects 1 in 8 couples. That means, think about your friends. I mean, 1 in 8 of them are experiencing infertility, right, in some form. And that's an enormous, if you extrapolate that number across all the people in this country, that's an enormous number, especially for an organization that has 12 full-time staff. That's it. They have 12 people. And so they really do rely on the efforts of volunteers, particularly when it comes to planning Advocacy Day and actually going and advocating for lowering the access to relief when it comes to infertility. And so they have some very ambitious ideas. Advocacy being one of them, the Advocacy Day that they set aside 1 day per year, they partner with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, ASRM. And the goal of the day is to sort of empower the community, patients, former patients like me, to sort of come together and have conversation with members of Congress about the need for increased access to family building options. So I mentioned that I went to the last one that was in person, which was a really rewarding experience because you got to walk the halls of Congress, you got to go into the offices of senators and United States representatives and speak to their staff or speak to the member directly about the need for their support. Now, every advocate is part of a larger delegation. At the time, the Illinois delegation that I was in, there were 4 of us. And so some delegations have 30 people in them, like California and sometimes Massachusetts. But there are very large delegations. There are smaller delegations. But nobody goes to a meeting alone. I know that you experienced that. And everyone gets to make this pitch. So this is my 5th year participating in Advocacy Day. My 2nd year as co-chair of the volunteer committee, sort of the planning committee for Advocacy Day. I have a wonderful partner, Lisa Rosenthal. She's a patient advocate from Connecticut who I could not do this without. And so the volunteer committee, we plan this Advocacy Day, and we just had a meeting last night, and I was telling the group that, you know, all of the work that we've put in over the last many months to plan for this Advocacy Day, it's really coming into very sharp focus as to what it's going to look like a month from now on Advocacy Day. So I hope I'm answering your question, but I want to make sure that I share sort of how I got there and where I am right now as it relates to my role with Resolve. But I'm happy to share even more about that if you want to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I was just curious, like what would be, like what would somebody expect, like if they show up for Federal Advocacy Day? I know I have my experience with it, but...
It's a very good question because I think it can be very intimidating to some people. And so what Lisa and I have tried to do, at least if we can provide any direction to what Advocacy Day is going to look like, we've always focused on trying to simplify the process to take out some of that intimidation. For example, my first Advocacy Day, we would go into a meeting, we would share our own story of infertility, but then we would make the ask about very specific pieces of legislation that we need support from the member from. Okay. So for example, we need your support on, you know, I'm making up a number, Senate Bill 117, the Access to Infertility and Treatment Act. Can we ask you to co-sponsor the bill? And so I've always found that trying to make advocates policy experts is not a great idea. Let people tell their stories. And so simplifying the process in a way where, and I sound like a broken record with advocates sometimes, but I tell them, go into a meeting and answer 2 questions. If you can answer these 2 questions, you have done a very important thing. Number one, tell them why you're there. Okay. And so the why you're there is telling your story of infertility and some of the financial obstacles that you experienced as part of trying to treat a disease, right? So that's the why you're there. And the second question is, how can you help me? And so that how can you help me is really, can we count on your support for future legislation that can lower the barriers to some sort of financial relief when it comes to, you know, coverage for infertility or a number, any ways that you want to craft it. Okay. We want people to tell their story, more important than anything else, but we also want them to have the opportunity to make the ask. That's why they're there.
Yeah.
Right. And so by simplifying that process, what we're trying to do is take out those, you know, sometimes clumsy part of meetings and just give people the opportunity to make the pitch. Okay.
Yeah.
This is how infertility affected me. It's affecting 1 in 8 of your constituents. They need your help. And guess what? These people vote. Okay. And so they could really, really use your help on this legislation. It could go a long way to helping them have a family. And it's always important to emphasize these are pro-family issues, right? There's nothing more American than that. People that want to have a family can't, and they can do something to help them, right?
Absolutely.
And so here's another thing that's very, very important for advocates to understand. Your presence is enough, right? They don't need to share a story if they're not comfortable doing so. By being present, they're saying, see all these other people that are sharing their story, what they're telling you is unacceptable, right?
Right.
We as a country have to do more to help those who suffer from infertility. And I've seen it in meetings. I've been in meetings with members of Congress who have said, I see that this is an important issue to my constituents, and I'm going to be figuring out how I can help. Okay. Now, I've also seen members of Congress, you know, from the areas you would least expect. I've had a member of Congress tell me, Brian, you don't need to go any further. I know what you're going to tell me because I went through it myself. My wife and I have a child who was born as a result of IVF. And so that's the opportunity to say, you know, why does your insurance coverage allow you to treat the disease, but not your constituents, right? And so we should be really doing everything we can to lower the barriers. Now, another thing, the only ask of advocates is that they share their story or be present. They don't need to do anything else. They just show up on Advocacy Day. Result does all of the heavy lifting. They will provide you with the materials. They'll even give you background on the audience that you're meeting with to say, this is somebody who we met with last year who shared this story. And so maybe you can sort of tie that in. Like, for example, this is not really a story. These are facts. If I meet with Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, I'm going to say the first thing I'm going to say to him is, Senator Durbin, I'm your neighbor. I live in Chicago. I am a father. I'm an attorney. You and I are same. I'm not going to say that to him, but you know, I'm trying to draw a connection to the audience wherever I can so that they can sort of put themselves in a position of empathy when they're listening to us. Now, they resolve schedules the meetings. They will give you all the materials that you could possibly need to be present in a meeting or to share a story. You'll meet with a state captain. Every state has a captain who will sort of quarterback that delegation and assign speaking roles for the delegation based on, you know, an advocate's willingness to share.
Yeah.
You'll meet prior to Advocacy Day, and you'll have plenty of opportunities to prepare and be trained. I always tell people, listen, if you're interested in advocacy at all, whether it be for infertility coverage or otherwise, or specifically infertility coverage, there's no better way to start than at Federal Advocacy Day, because there's no obligation to participate in a way other than what you are comfortable with. You can sit there and observe, you can see how this is done. And I can promise you, if you do speak up, it is as exhilarating an experience as you will ever have. I remember after my first Advocacy Day, I said, can we do that again tomorrow? I would love to do that again tomorrow and the day after. It's a really, really enlightening and rewarding experience.
And I think the important thing too is you don't have like 30 minutes to tell your story. You have quick little elevator speeches and you get help preparing for that. Cause I remember from my own experience trying to figure out like, what am I going to, like, there's so much that I could talk about. Like I could talk for hours on reasons why. I think once you got into it, like I think my last one of the day like was so much better than the first one, because I realized like what's going to be the most important things to point out, and not necessarily to get into like the nitty gritty of the details, just like the main points and being able to have your story heard. I'm always one to say like, you never know who needs to hear your story. Because like I've been in presentations that have had 4 people and some for 20, 30, 40, you know, like more. And the one that I had for people, like just listening about infertility and mental health, one of the workers, one of the foster care workers, was going through infertility herself and felt very validated about like her experience. So from there, like, it's like you just never know who needs to hear that story, because we all know somebody that has either we've personally experienced it, like, or know somebody that has.
I actually take a different approach in the meetings than I shouldn't say. There's no ordinary story to tell.
Yeah.
I mean, every story is extraordinary in its own way. But, you know, whenever I am asking for support on these issues, what I'm generally saying is, look, I need you to, my audience, to understand that the number one barrier to treatment for infertility, in other words, the number one barrier to having a family for 1 in 8 couples, is the cost and access to health insurance that covers infertility. Okay. Specifically IVF, the mandates across state lines, there's only, you know, a very limited number of states who mandate coverage for IVF. Some states mandate coverage for diagnosis, right? But not the actual treatment itself. And so my wife and I were incredibly lucky in that both of us at the time were working for employers who provided benefits that covered some of the cost of IVF. And so those benefits eventually ran out.
Yeah.
But they were an enormous help to us. Frankly, if we didn't have those benefits, would we have continued to pursue the family that we had hoped we were going to have? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I'm frankly feel very fortunate that we didn't have to find out. And so that's the story that I tell when I meet with lawmakers. And I ask the question, why were we afforded this opportunity simply because of the work we did or the state that we lived in? That just makes no sense, right? And so affording people the opportunity to try to have a family is what we're asking for.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to recognize, and great topic to segue into, is a lot of times like Resolve is federal, but then we also have state. There are states that have mandated coverage and there's states that don't. And for me in Wisconsin, I'm part of Building Families Alliance, and that's what we're trying to do, is trying to get Wisconsin to be the next state to have mandated insurance coverage. Because in Wisconsin, it's estimated about 172,000 people in Wisconsin are impacted by infertility. And a lot of them don't have access. Mm-hmm. And if you think about even just access and clinics, you know, we have Madison, Milwaukee, but what about northern Wisconsin? There's a lot of people that are traveling 3-4 hours, you know, to go to a clinic. So there's the access that way, but fertility, like being able to have that coverage, would help eliminate one of the main stressors of fertility treatments is the cost. You know, you hear about people taking out second mortgages, you know, taking out health loans. You know, I had read a story in where it was a social worker in Minnesota, and she took out a second full-time job, was working 80 hours a week for a month, and she couldn't handle it. I mean, like, it was too much for her and too much for anybody, to be honest. And she ended up resigning, took out the COBRA insurance. And it was actually still cheaper to pay for IVF doing COBRA. So she worked those 80 out. I'm like, I can't even, it shouldn't be that hard.
No.
You know, and I think it's, like I said, it's important to advocate federally, because federal will sometimes trickle down to state level, right?
Yeah.
But also advocating for your state as well, especially if you're not, if you're in one that doesn't have that coverage.
Right.
And like, we have National Infertility Awareness Week coming up, you know, so, and it's like, well, it wasn't one of the first times that Resolve has it the same federal advocacy day, the same week as National Infertility Awareness Week, which is awesome.
This is the first time ever where advocacy day is happening at the same time as National Infertility, within National Infertility Awareness Week. And so we're taking all of the resources and the power that gets put into National Infertility Awareness Week and amplifying Advocacy Day in that way. And I think that it's, I think it's a really smart decision not made by me. But I think it could have an everlasting impact that we're really trying to accomplish here. Now, you talked about efforts at the state level. I want to tie that back to something I said earlier about the easiest way to get involved in Advocacy Day or to experience advocacy itself is to show up for Federal Advocacy Day in the way that you're most comfortable with, because this is an effort at the federal level to sort of create this umbrella for the entire country to protect anyone who wants to try to have a family or give them access. However, obviously it's much easier to accomplish and see results at the state level. And that's what Resolve is doing, is they are putting together advocacy efforts in every state, anywhere they can attempt to expand the access to coverage. They're doing it at the state level. I've always viewed Resolve sort of as a watchdog at the state level when it comes to reproductive rights. And they've seen great success, by the way, in their efforts to expand coverage at the state level, you know, whether it be currently attempts in Washington State or any other state advocacy efforts for reproductive rights that are involved.
Yeah, because I think Wisconsin was doing it. Oregon's, I think, is under process. Minnesota is introducing legislation. So, I mean, there are a number of states, and I'm sure, like I said, Building Families Wisconsin, that's really our focus. We have a number of events during National Infertility Awareness Week, and I would imagine other states are doing the same thing with those efforts, because it is like that targeted kind of social media explosion. And I think the big thing too is, like, even if you don't want to share your story, like I said, you can show up and observe and be there as a body. Social media is there as well. Like, I had posted, it was somebody on CBS News. It was like one of the news anchors had a story about their IVF. And I had posted that, and there was people that I didn't even know, like, had done IVF. And like you said, if that's how you want to share your story, do that. You know, find a way to share that experience, because I don't know. Do you know who Brene Brown is? Have you heard of her? Mm-mm. Okay. Brene Brown is a social worker, and she has some really tremendous books, like The Gifts of Imperfection, Daring Greatly, and then a number of them. And in the book Daring Greatly, a lot of her research is based on shame and stigma. And one of the things that she had said in there, which I'm paraphrasing, but the only way that we can reduce shame and stigma is by normalizing the situation. And we normalize it through conversation. And that's really your story, is it's a conversation with somebody that has an open ear and listening. And the more that we share,
powerful.
Right. The more we share our story, the more, like, other people need to hear it. It's like, that's why, like I said, you never know who needs to hear it. And it's about creating that awareness that this is more prevalent than you think. So
yeah, I can't tell you how many times Lindsay, my wife, and I shared our struggle with infertility in the ways that we were most comfortable with, only to be met with a response that we often heard, which was, yeah, us too, you know. Yeah. So it is comforting, it's helpful, and we see it as this advocacy as the opportunity to have a meaningful impact on the next generation of people who may experience what we did, because frankly it can be a very devastating and lonely experience. What I say, just to sort of emphasize the experience that we had, it's not to say that we didn't recover from this, but there was certainly a lot of sadness in our home.
Yeah.
Because we weren't able to have a family the way that we wanted to have a family. And we found support in the most remarkable ways, whether it be through friends or Resolve or, you know, the support of the community of people who had experienced infertility and gone down the path of parenthood through surrogacy. And so, and so we've decided to share that. Not everybody is as comfortable to sharing those experiences, but we've found it to be incredibly rewarding because we see the sort of impact that this can, these types of conversations can have. This is, I want to be very clear about one thing, that Advocacy Day and advocating for coverage for infertility, it's an enormous challenge that is certainly not lost on anybody who sort of raises their hand and says, I want to advocate for these, this type of coverage. But infertility, the way we have viewed it and so many others have, is that it certainly doesn't define us. The support of the larger community, if you want that, can help you get through it. And when you do get through it as a community or with your partner or by yourself, there is a greater reward on the other side of it. And the longer that we sort of chip away at these lawmakers, we're not going to see results this year, but the longer that we chip away at these lawmakers, the shorter the distance is and the closer we get to realizing that insurance should cover infertility like a disease. It is. And then we'll see an expansion of access to reproductive care and not the other way around, not sort of clawing back everything that we've accomplished so far. We are a lot closer than it may seem. And I have a lot of hope for the very near future of the pro-family legislation that we're going to be advocating for this year and next year and every year after until we see the change we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, exactly. There is kind of a complete long game to this. It's not a short, like everything's going to be passed in 2 months. I mean, there's been a lot of efforts that have already been made that you're just building on that long game and working like the legislators and saying like, hey, like this is something that impacts a lot.
My co-chair, Lisa, she gets tired of me saying this because it's just a reminder, but I always say, this is an endurance test. Advocacy is an endurance test. And I've never met a group of people more resilient than advocates for infertility coverage. I just haven't. They're never going away.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many people that volunteer. I mean, even within Wisconsin, I think with Building Families, we have like 500 or 600 people that are
volunteer
lists. You know,
that's great. So
that's just one state. You know, like you times up. I mean, there's a lot. You know, and that, I mean, that's another thing about Federal Advocacy Day is you meet other people. I would have never have met you if I did. You know,
Our
co-chairs in Wisconsin, like I have some connection. Like we're all now working with Building Families. So like you don't never know. Like it's great people to have in your network of people. Like they're awesome people and. Like I said, you're all there for the same purpose, you know, and if all have some experience with it and all of our experiences will be different because that's what it is. You know, we all have that understanding of like, yeah, we all been through it.
It will have an impact.
The
audiences that we're speaking to at the federal and state level, I've seen staff members cry because they've said, they pause and they say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to become emotional, but I'm going through infertility treatment right now.
Yeah.
And guess what? Sometimes those staff members have a lot, just as much power as the member themselves, because they're the ones that sort of provide direction as to the issues that are really important to that particular member. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, Ryan, I definitely appreciate your time and being able to talk about your life as a reproductive lawyer, as well as the resolve and advocacy.
I'm going to make one pitch, Stephen. If anybody is listening and they're interested in advocacy, it's not too late. I don't know when this will air, but Advocacy Day is April 25th this year. It is virtual. You can sign up on resolve.org. Just follow the prompts to Advocacy Day. I can't emphasize enough how profound the impact is for anyone who has experienced infertility, anyone whose family has been affected by infertility, how profound their impact could be on Advocacy Day. And so encourage people to participate again in any ways that they're most comfortable with. I think that you'll find it to be, as I explained earlier, a very exhilarating experience, and we'd be happy to have anybody join us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will put a link in the show notes as well to highlight and give that so people can just click on it and register. And yeah, and also like Building Fund Wisconsin has a number of events during that week as well. You know,
perfect.
I know like on the, or obviously they, like we are focused on that, but like on the other days of the week, we do have certain events. And yeah, so there's definitely, there's always ways where you can get involved with however comfortable you feel, whether that's writing your story, whether that's showing up and saying in person, your story matters. And you never know who needs to hear it.
Thanks for everything that you're doing. And thanks for having me, Stephen.
Yeah, no problem. Awesome. Thank you for listening to the Miles Podcast. Miles Podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com. And I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.